So I'd like to introduce now our friend Ketan Sheth, very distinguished lawyer, counsellor, lead governor at Central North West London Foundation Trust, who's going to chair the session this evening, and he's going to introduce our very distinguished panel as well. So welcome everyone, and over to you, Ketan.
Thank you, Judith, for that incredibly warm welcome. So friends, good to see you all. Good evening to each of you. And welcome to this community discussion about how food equality leads to health equality, which I am very pleased, as you just heard Judith say, co-hosting with my good friends at HealthWatch Brand and the Advocacy Project. So, I am Ketan Sheth, a counselor here in Brent and chair of Community and Wellbeing Scrutiny Committee. I'm also the lead governor at Central and Northwest London NHS Foundation Trust, where I am one of the people who represent the public interest in the thinking around decisions it takes. The NHS is often said to be a misnomer, as it's really a national illness service. Absolutely essential and does a great job for the sick and the injured. It was also a calculation back in 1948 that once the illness backlog was cleared over a decade or so, that NHS spending would reduce. But friends, there was a big surprise as the NHS dispensed 7.5 million pairs of glasses a year in its early days. This led to a political crisis and the beginnings of an understanding that there was more to health than founders thought. Clean drinking water and waste disposal historically are amongst the most significant contributions to longer and healthier lives. We also know how folic acid to flour and for pregnant people and fluoride for drinking water in some areas for better dental health. Laws on food quality and the work of the Food Standards Agency are taken for granted now, but the earliest English food laws included the excise of bread and ale introduced in 2066 about the quality, weight and price of bread and beer. A significant development about food quality and its price. Malnutrition still exists. We still read heartbreaking stories of abuse, sometimes poverty. You may recall the story from Blackpool of children eating paper at school. And more positively, the recent work of the great footballer Marcus Rashford addressing food insecurity at schools in holiday times. Another aspect of malnutrition is obesity, particularly childhood obesity, children's tooth decay and oral health, causing enormous damage to people's health. And with people from poorer background and some ethnic minorities where it is disproportionately higher. And again, we know this only too well, how the pandemic has disproportionately impacted ethnic minorities. Clearly, there is a lot going on with food. And pandemic has really shone a light on health inequalities, which we have known about for a long time, and now the urgent need to do something about it. So friends, tonight we are looking at how all these things interact. Quality, diet, price, living circumstances, anxiety, and more. I have got some great friends of mine to start off this important conversation. Of course, this is hugely important and complex discussion, and the hour that we have won't be enough. But I'm very keen for us to start off this conversation and for my guest this evening to highlight some of the good work they are doing and what more we all can do going forward. So friends, my first guest this evening is my great friend, Dr. Landia Bosch, who is joining us all the way from Washington, D.C. Landia has a PhD from the University of Cambridge in health geography. I'm grateful to the work that he did for my childhood obesity report only a couple of years ago. He's the leading expert in the relationship between childhood obesity, childhood overweight in primary school children, and the energy expenditure, as well as built public spaces. So, Landia, all the way from Washington, D.C., all the way from the World Bank, it is really good to see you. It'd be really good if you could spend the next 5 minutes or so highlighting for us some of the key aspects that you came across when you were doing your research paper, please.
Fantastic, Ketan. Thank you very much for the introduction, and good afternoon from DC. Good evening to all of you over there in the UK. It's wonderful to see such a broad audience and a great set of panelists to discuss the crucial role that food plays in determining health outcomes. As Ketan said, I'm Landia Bosch, and I'm a geographer of health. And that means that my research focuses on studying the impact of the environment in which we live on our health and well-being. I'm currently, as Ketan said, working for the development branch of the World Bank Group in Washington, D.C., but I recently completed my PhD from the University of Cambridge with a study on the drivers of childhood overweight and obesity in London, and that's what I'll be talking about today. It's important to note that as a geographer, I do not look at questions of health through a biomedical lens. I look at how surroundings, in this case, the built characteristics of the neighborhoods and the city which we live in, how they influence our behaviors, and how those behaviors then result in poorer or better health outcomes. And for my PhD, I therefore did not look at the genetics of overweight and obesity, but at how the city, how London, shapes our day-to-day life and what it is about certain environments in London that lead us to see more or less childhood overweight and obesity. And childhood obesity in particular remains a major public health concern in London as around the globe, although it's a largely preventable condition. Childhood obesity levels in London are high, as almost a quarter of year six pupils is currently living with obesity. And despite tremendous efforts, both from the science and the policy side, we've not been able to turn the tide on children's weight. In the last 10 years, nearly all boroughs have seen an increase in overweight and obesity among their child and youth population. So in recent years, there has been increased attention to the role of the place where children live in determining their food consumption and physical activity, influencing their body shapes. And that's what geographers of health study and the topic of my PhD research in London. And I'd like to focus on one specific part of that research, which was set in the neighborhoods of Newham and Brent, both boroughs with above average levels of children living with obesity, with over 25% of children confronted with that condition. Aside from a large-scale statistical study involving around 2,000 primary school children in London, I wanted to zoom in on specific neighborhoods to figure out how the environment that kids live in determines their food consumption and physical activity with an impact on their body weight. And to that end, I invited a very diverse group of 60 children in years 3, 4, and 5 to participate in a study of their neighborhoods and their behaviors. And what we did was something called walk-along interviews, whereby the interview is carried out while walking through the neighborhood. And questions about the neighborhood and the effect on behavior arise in real life and real time. And it provides a unique insight into how children perceive their surroundings, how they act, and what factors in their surroundings actually drive healthy and unhealthy behaviors. And to complete that picture, children also wore an activity tracker for a week and recorded their behaviors in a journal for 7 days. And the results that came out of that study were quite concerning, as 90% of participating children did not meet minimum physical activity requirements, in particular girls, younger children, and those who commute to school using cars. And what stood out was the impact of the environment on decisions related to both food consumption and physical activity. Especially the commute on the way home after school was concerning, as the children and their parents or caretakers were found to frequently stop at convenience stores or fast food shops, in particular chicken and chip shops, to purchase foodstuffs that were mainly unhealthy and energy-dense products, such as sweets, which served as a kind of treat after a long school day or a quick and easy fried dinner. And the exposure to food outlets along the roadside implies a perhaps subconscious encouragement to consume unhealthy food products. On the other hand, the parents who picked up their children from school using cars often tied that school run to a food shop elsewhere in the neighborhood after school, as they are often at a distance from urban centers and require a drive. So the centralization of supermarkets and other shops in large retail parks outside residential areas seems to increase that car-based commuting and linking up that food consumption with the school run. And the buying of energy-dense products is often for want of a better, healthier option, which is not easily available in the neighborhood. And what we saw in both Newman and Brent is that parts of London are what is described as food deserts, places where there is a lack of healthy food options, leading to increased consumption of unhealthy items. And my PhD found us that the structure and the layout of the city plays an important role in determining children's and families' food habits, which needs to be addressed together with the biomedical aspects to structurally change and reduce the levels of childhood overweight and obesity seen among children in London boroughs. The dietary patterns and the activity patterns that we observe, as well as the health outcomes, are thus not the result of the individual choice of children or their parents, or their responsibility necessarily. They're often tied up with the environment in which people reside, which needs to be shaped to the benefit of all, not only those struggling with overweight or obesity. And I'm very happy, as Ketan said, that we have been working together with Brent on this and improving that through the obesity steering group, which has been great. Let me stop there. I think that's about 5 minutes. Happy to take any questions also down the line. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for that, Lander, and thank you for providing that great insight. And I think some of the issues that you highlighted, of course, we have known about it for a very long time, as I was saying in my opening remarks, but of course, all of that has been rather escalated with the pandemic impacts. And we will try and explore one or two of those in a moment or two. But let me bring our friend Etty Kong in now. She is a senior GP in Westminster, and previously she was the chair of Brent Clinical Commissioning Group and responsible for planning and commissioning many of the health services for people living in and around Brent. So Dr. Etty is also a trustee of the Ashford Place, a charity which supports the health and well-being of homeless people, as well as a founding trustee of Brent Chinese Association. Etty, really good to have you this evening. And I would be very grateful if you could share what's happening in your surgery. And particularly, I know you have been leading a focused piece of work around the Afghanistan community who have been coming into the country in the recent weeks and months. Thank you.
Thank you. I have been a GP now for 35 years. So I've seen the change in demographics of our population, the disease profile, as well as lifestyle changes, etc. So eating for health and food as a medicine is actually a theme that is coming through these days. Over the years, what we have done is we become very dependent on medicines, one tablet for one disease, rather than looking at ourselves, at our lifestyles, and see how we can change in order to improve. So diabetes has been on the increase, childhood obesity, as we mentioned, children's oral health, heart disease, arthritis. All those diseases are related to our lifestyle as well as our food style as well. So it is very important for us to focus on our wellness based on lifestyle. So it's very important for health professionals not to look at patients as a patient with disease or conditions, but looking at patients as how we can have a healthier person, age-related with aging, but aging in a way that is in healthy, in a healthy lifestyle. So what we haven't done well is to promote healthy lifestyle alongside with the traditional, conventional medicine of treating patients. So that's one thing I have recognized. Again, the other thing about as health professionals, we are very quick at giving advice, but we tend to forget that giving advice is easy. For the recipient of advice to change is difficult. So we have to wait for the right moment of change. Hence, I come to the cycle of change. So we need to give advice to patients at the right time, in the right when they're in the right frame. So a lot of times I look at myself and I look at my peers. We say, stop smoking, eat healthily, blah, blah, blah. It's easy to say. So time actually is quite a good tool. We have to wait sometimes until the patient is in the right window of contemplation of the cycle of change. And only then we can facilitate change, support change, in order for them to maintain a healthy lifestyle. So that's all I want to say about being a clinician, looking after the patients, not to be one-dimensional anymore on just treating patients with the drugs we have or whatever it is. So I'm moving on to saying, a health professional should work very closely now with the social prescribers, so that social prescribers being our complementary friend who will prescribe non-drugs, and when it needs to, we prescribe the drugs. I will stop there.
Thank you very much for that, Etty. And one of our friends is just putting some words in the chat about education, and that takes us very nicely to our friend Danny. And Etty, you talked about breaking this the cycle of change, and one person who certainly has been breaking that cycle of change is Danny. So Danny Coyle is the head teacher of Newman Catholic College, a secondary school in Harleston, which has a strong ethos of serving the common good. When it became clear during the pandemic how many families were facing difficulties buying enough food, Danny decided to support families who had got into debt waiting for their first payment of universal credit, while others were asylum seeking with no recourse to a public fund. And this is the head teacher of a secondary school who you would not think would have the time or the energy or the resource to be doing so much of common good. And I'm so grateful that he's been able to find a time to join us this evening. So tell us what's been happening in Harleston, Danny.
Thank you, Councillor. Colleagues, nice to see you all. Good evening. I'm at home now in Haringey, left Harleston a couple of hours ago, so it's great to be here with you. In terms of the question of food equality and equaling health equality, just to anecdote the beginning of this presentation, of course the two things are linked, but it really came home to me during lockdown, because as we know, the whole experience just shone a light on the pernicious inequality in our society. So by about the end of March, remember lockdown in schools in the UK started on the 20th of March. By the end of March, it was being reported back to me by heads of year and form tutors that parents were telling us that we're going hungry. We're skipping breakfast. We've not enough food for the day. Now, that made me realise, of course, that free school meals and a regular school hot meal, which is pretty healthy, plays a really important part in keeping families healthy and sustained. And when that was taken away during those turbulent, difficult few months of the lockdown, before things improved, it really brought it home to us how much people were suffering. Families were going hungry. And that began a whole change in the way we began to operate at a school. whilst, of course, maintaining an academic focus, we began to shift out and focus on delivering food and money to people, and more of that later. But essentially, the job of the school is to educate children. And education, of course, has various domains. Schools are actually legally obliged to teach children about healthy eating. I won't quote the national curriculum, key stage 1, 2, 3, and 4. You can do it yourself. I've got it here on my phone. But it's quite clear. Schools have to teach about healthy eating and how it works and how children can prepare a healthy meal. We in our school have a healthy school policy, which means no junk food, no fizzy drinks. I've been working in schools in London since the 1980s, and I can remember, you know, certainly at the start of that period, having you know, Coke machines and chocolate bars in school, and the children were all over the place, let alone doing ultimate damage to the physical well-being. That doesn't happen anymore. You know, we search kids' bags. And these days, children understand that if they bring something into school that is unhealthy, it will be confiscated, and probably by the teachers, but that's a whole other different argument. When it comes to food technology, we teach food technology. Children cook every day in our school. We have a nice kitchen. We grow our own food. Working with Harsden Mutual Aid Society, we come in every Saturday and the kids grow vegetables and we cook them, and they're part of our canteen. So that whole educational process of how food works. Of course, we're part of the Right to Food Conference, which is happening at our school on the 12th of March, where hopefully we'll get many of you to come along and talk about how we can best support the local community in educating themselves about healthy eating. But there's also more to it as well. We work very closely with Advice for Renters, a wonderful woman called Pat Fernandez, who comes in and educates our families about how to be wise regarding spending and how you can get the same quality food for the cheaper price if you're smart about how the whole thing works. We have food banks. Now, I'm not particularly proud of this. You know, we live in the fifth richest country in the world, and I've got 30 or 40 families lining up outside school every Friday afternoon collecting food. We're meeting a need in the community. I think we must recognise that sport is a fundamental part of keeping our children healthy. And we need to think very carefully about what's happened in places like Harlesden, when there's no community centres anymore, there's no after-school activities. The only things going on are schools and teachers pretty much keeping them open till 5 and 6 o'clock. That's not sustainable, really. So what happened to all the youth clubs? What's happened to the organised sports activities that certainly were a key part of my childhood? What about feeding children in the evening? I put in about a dozen bids over the last few years to try to set up a system where children can stay in school till 6 o'clock and have a healthy meal about 6 o'clock in the evening. No success with that. I was really interested to hear about Mr. Lander Bosch's discussion of the investigation into what was going on in Brent. We did something very similar, and I'm probably getting out of my depth now here, Lander, but we did something called the C3 Collaborating for Health, where a number of parents and pupils came to Newman on a couple of Saturdays and walked around the area with software doing exactly what you've described. We're trying to raise more money to do it again. And the identification of areas of pollution, of poor housing, of lack of green spaces, of the propensity of fast food shops was absolutely astonishing in the Harlesden area. So we do a lot, I think, as a school. I won't mention the summer camp just yet, but I think it's about education. I don't want to sound like Tony Blair here, but we have a responsibility as teachers and parents to educate our children about every facet of their development and their upbringing. And eating healthy and being smart about food is a central facet of the teacher's role. I'll finish there, Ketan. I'm just about 5 minutes.
Thank you very much indeed for that, Denny. You've talked a great deal about keeping family healthy and doing that in a very sustainable way. And our friend who knows all about that is Salma Meher. Salma, so good to see you with that beaming smile on your face. Thank you very much and good evening to you. So Salma, many of you will know her, is a consultant dietitian with the NHS. She is currently working with the Diabetes Transformation Program, developing educational resources for ethnic minority populations to improve health literacy and outcomes. Salma is also a co-author of the best-selling book, World Foods, So thank you, Salma. And it'd be good to understand a little bit more about the diet and the importance that Denny was referencing just a moment ago, Salma.
Thank you so much, Ketan, for the wonderful introduction. It's always a pleasure to be here and very humbled for that introduction. If you're happy for me to just share a few slides, because I like showing
Please
some of the
do.
Images, is that
Please.
Okay? So I'm going to just quickly run through some slides, really just trying to show people some of the work that we've done. Can I just ask, can you all see my slides? Lovely. So just to give you a little bit of flavor of my background and what I've been doing. So I am very privileged to live and work in Brent. I was born in Brent, and way before the pandemic, I have had an invested interest in looking at the demographics and education of our populations across Northwest London. I cover a very big region, but Brent is one of them. And I've had the privilege of working with many voluntary organizations and also social organizations in Brent around the education and prevention awareness of type 2 diabetes, obesity, particularly in some of the ethnic minority communities. Now, there have been their fair challenges when I've been doing this, and we know from the COVID pandemic that health inequalities has really come out. But way before we started this, we knew that there is limited knowledge and resources out there for our communities. There's also limited access to health because of some of the language barriers, the cultural barriers, and also people's awareness of the importance of good nutrition and also good health in their families. So further to that, myself and my colleague, Dr. Jones St. John, about 5 years ago, we set aside some time and money to do very specific tailored work with particular communities, looking at what we've looked at is high density food around high carbohydrate intake in particularly the South Asian community, where my colleague, Dr. Ethi Kong, mentioned that, you know, we don't really focus on nutrition very much. We're very clinical. And I, being a clinician in the last 20 years, there's been a huge shift around medication, insulins, and also new therapies coming out, but very, very little investment and time in developing the resources, and specifically around tailoring the education to cultural needs has really been limited in Brent. But what COVID has taught us that we do need to make sure that this we do tailor the information to our communities. But we've been quite privileged in Brent to be working with a lot of the communities locally. So we work very closely with the Iraqi community, with the South Asian, the Somali, and also with the Afro-Caribbean and the Caribbean communities, looking at the type of foods they have, where they cook, where they shop, where they buy their foods. And we are very fortunate to have this information and share that knowledge with the communities that we work with. So we then went on to developing a resource called the World Food Book, which is one of its kind because it really reflects on the real foods that people eat. So we're not talking about the high street foods. We're not talking about the restaurant foods. We're talking about foods that people resonate with, which they're familiar with, with their daily intake of foods that they would eat is listed in this book. But what we have done is we've helped people look at the portions, the values. So whether people are interested in calories or carbohydrates or proteins, we've really simplified this in this book. What we wanted to showcase is that what we eat, how we eat, and how it impacts our day-to-day blood glucose impact. Because our interest was very much showing people how food impacts your diabetes. And that's what this simple resource is doing. Moving on, we really have changed the way we educate people in how to generate sort of visual libraries of foods that people can connect with. So showing them how to cook, how to prepare, and also how to dish out food. So simple images like this can really help people understand how they should portion control and how they should really think about healthier eating. So not necessarily changing the way they eat, but just having a look at how they dish out and how they distribute food. Now, we know we are in this huge race for digital era and trying to get everything onto digital because of COVID or because of the limited resources that we do have in clinic. Being a clinician, we know that in a day we can only see a certain number of people, but the race of type 2 diabetes is way faster than what the resources that we have in clinic at the moment. So moving on to the smart era of digital diabetes, we are creating more and more language-specific resources, culturally specific, so people can access this information once they know about it and are taught how to use this digital resources. We've really focused very much on connecting people to festivities which are really important to their lives. So for example, Ramadan is around the corner. We're doing a lot of work so that we can engage with people and bring the importance of healthy eating in these sort of festivals. So Diwali, Ramadan, whether it's Vaisakhi, whether it's the Buddhist celebrations, we try to connect with people through celebrations and festivals which are important to them. Moving on, we've really tried to change the way we are sharing healthy advice. So it's not just about healthy eating. It's really about creating and bringing the evidence. So whether it's low carbohydrate, whether it's intermittent fasting, whether it's very low calorie diets, the evidence is there, but we need to make sure that the evidence is transformed into culturally specific advice. This work does take a lot of time, but once it's developed, it can be distributed to thousands of people, not just in Northwest London, but across the country as well. So moving on, we've done lots of videos. So historically, we would have had videos on very generic foods, what people are familiar with. So for example, having breakfast, which is, you know, egg and beans. But then we've got to also realize that not everybody would eat these foods for breakfast. So we have tried to transform this information into specific foods, creating videos and also voice recording some of these videos into different languages. We know that if these resources are available and shared and distributed with amongst healthcare professionals, they then can be distributed to more families and also individuals living with long-term conditions. Childhood obesity we touched on today, but what we really need to understand is, again, when we're talking about childhood obesity, we need to recognize the communities, the culture, the diet within these communities. So recognizing what is available out there, what can be provided for these children, and are there suitable resources that we can share with these families to bridge some of these health inequalities? We do a lot of education around eating on budgets. I'm not going to talk about that because one of our colleagues today has talked about this. But just to share with you some of the experiences that I've been working with some of the schools in locally, where we bring in families from different ethnic minority communities and together and showcase very simple resources, simple messages and simple ways to teach people the importance of change, the importance of reducing high sugar, high fat foods in children's diets, and also where they can purchase healthier foods and snacks as well. It's not always about financial or money or availability. It's sometimes really going back to the basics of giving them that education and bridging some of the barriers in terms of languages and also resources as well. Lastly, I just wanted to say that we do showcase a lot of success stories, particularly around people from the ethnic minority communities, because often we feel that some people don't always come forward because they feel that the services are not suitable for these communities. But we do want to bridge these health inequalities by showing people that, yes, people from these communities are uptaking the healthier resources or programs, and they have achieved really, really good success rates. So by sharing some of these stories is really encouraging for other people from these communities as well. I could talk forever about some of the work that we've done here at Brent, but just lastly, showing that how I get people to share what they eat, how they eat, how cooking can be cost effective, how healthy eating can be cost effective. And what we do is we have a really, we've got a new Facebook page where in Northwest London, where we're asking people to bring their culture foods, share it with us and showcase how they are transforming their diets into healthier practices. So I'm really just going to stop there and take this opportunity to take questions, which I think we're going to do at the end. So thank you all for listening. I'll stop sharing and hand over to Kevin.
Thank you very much, Salma, for that. Really, I'm grateful. And talking about showcasing, one person who's been doing plenty of that in the recent weeks and months during the pandemic is Rajesh Makwana, who is the director of SUFRA Northwest London, a community food and support hub that provides emergency aid and holistic range of services to those experiencing poverty, homelessness and financial crisis. Rajesh is also a trustee for the Independent Food Aid Network, a UK-wide body that supports around 500 food banks and advocates for an end to food poverty. Rajesh, I know, you're doing an amazing work here in St. Raphael's. It'd be good to share that good news story with our friends on the Zoom, please.
Thank you so much for the introduction, Councillor Sheff, and lovely to be here. Really great to hear all the wonderful work that's going on from all the previous speakers. Just to give you a bit of background then about SIFRA, as Ketan said, it's basically much more than a food bank. The food bank and the food aid services we provide, the food bank per se, as well as our community kitchen and a range of other services, are gateway services so that people can access more holistic support designed to address the causes of food poverty and to reduce dependency upon food aid. And that's really increasingly the focus for us, because it is just absolutely unsustainable to continue giving people charitable handouts of food. So the sort of services we provide include, as I've mentioned, a community kitchen where we cook food and people eat together in a communal space, in a social space. We have an NHS service where we provide emergency food parcels to patients on discharge from hospital if they are likely to go home to empty cupboards. We have an advice service. We have full-time advice workers who provide support to refugees, asylum seekers, and to other food bank guests to address housing problems, benefit problems, other financial problems, etc. We provide a range of AQA-accredited training and employability programs, and we operate and help manage a large community garden. Which is a social therapeutic space and also a growing project where we produce a lot of organic fruit and vegetables as well as eggs. We have many chickens in a chicken coop. So there's a lot going on, basically, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's lots of little projects that I haven't mentioned there that are happening. And there are obvious links and connections there with the issue of health and health equality. So just to pick up on some of these quickly, and then just to talk more generally about health equality, the food providing somebody with food, if they can't access that food for whatever reason, is clearly going to benefit them in that it will give them access to some reasonably nutritious food. Our food parcels, we operate in a very different way now post-pandemic than we used to before the pandemic, where we pre-pack our parcels and we went through during the pandemic doing lots of deliveries. We've had a nutritional report done and we'll be publishing that soon. And we're surprised to find actually it's reasonably balanced, the food parcels that we provide, apart from the bag of sugar, which we've now made upon request rather than the standard item in the food parcel. We run a food academy program for young people, which teaches young people about the provenance of food, how to cook food on a relatively low budget. The community garden that we operate encourages people of all ages to come along and grow organic food, which is obviously good for their nutritional requirements, but for their physical and mental well-being as well, being out in the fresh air and working together to grow some food. So there's lots going on there that has a direct connection to health equality. But I would say from a food bank's perspective, the issue of food equality equating to health equality is a bit of a red herring. Providing somebody with all the food that they need is not going to address the structural inequalities that lead to the food insecurity and the health problems that bring them to the food bank in the first place. So really, we're just putting a sticking plaster on a much, much bigger problem, and it's not the solution at all. The real issue is simply poverty, which is caused by many different inequalities and injustice within society. Creating health equality means addressing these inequalities and addressing the real drivers of poverty, some of which include a benefit system that is not really fit for purpose. A lot of the people that we support are receiving all the benefits that they're due, but they still can't afford to buy the food that they need and pay the rent and the bills, etc. Low wages and precarious jobs, sky-high extortionate rents that people are paying in the private sector, a lack of skills and low educational attainment. The list can go on. There are many proximal causes and more complex systemic causes that lead people to the food bank. And really, to address health inequality, we need to be looking much more towards them. Further than that, I would say at the same time that access to food is a human right, and it's a human right that governments must be able to safeguard. But food as a human right needs to be considered in the broader context of other social and economic rights that accompany the right to food. People need access to housing, they need access to decent work, they need access to clothing, they need access to relevant support in old age or when they're unemployed, they need access to decent healthcare, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a complex issue, this. We bring people together and there's something really, just really basic about eating together, about being together in a room, sharing food, growing food together. It really speaks to, our inner nature. But doing that is not really the solution. We really need to look at broader ways of addressing the health inequalities that we're talking about today. So just a quick one from me there.
Thank you very much indeed. You raise a very long list of very complex issues. And as I said in my opening words, that we could never do justice within an hour. But as I said a couple of times, that this is just the start of the conversation and get us all talking. And I'm so pleased that we are talking about this hugely important as well as complex subject matter. Now I'm going to pick up, we've got about 10 minutes left, and I'm going to very quickly pick up a few points. And if I can ask our friends to be as brief as possible so we can take a few questions, please, within the 10 minutes time that we have left. And let me just go to Etty first. So we know the high prevalence of type 2 diabetes and obesity and oral health, heart disease, et cetera, Etty. But how important do you think the role of food play in the wellness, bearing in mind, as few of our friends have mentioned in the chat, the spiraling cost of living, and which, of course, our friends have also referenced?
It is becoming more obvious that food and healthy lifestyle both are important to our wellness. So looking traditionally at our health in the conventional way, we know it's not the best way. So I think within the 10 minutes consultation that we have with doctors especially, we don't have the time and the forum to discuss that, but we should change our role as frontline clinicians to be able to start off to start the conversation and then signpost our patients to the right professionals like Salma, who got the time to explain to them, and families who do not have the financial means to have food, we would say, go to the food bank or whatever it is. So it's very important now within health, we just don't concentrate on the traditional way of practicing medicine. We have to change our methodology. So that's that. So we got to be not only as healers, but as health promoters as well in our new ways going forward. And we need to be also, I think, recognize that I would say equality doesn't mean equity. Those two are different things. So equality is giving everybody the same thing, correct? That is equality. But then once you have that, how to reach equity is different. So we need to treat different population, different sectors of our communities differently so that we can get to the end point of equity of care. So I think our language, our approach to healthcare needs to change and think more about health promotion, disease prevention and wellness and social, medical, psychological well-being.
Thank you. So our concept of
looking at patients when they come to us must change. Yeah.
Thank you for that, Eddie. Well, we've talked about Salma's famous book. Here it is. And I think Judith has already put a link in the chat. And talking about your book, Salma, I'm keen to understand what type of foods should we be eating? Particularly, we talked about the aspiring cost. On a very tight budget, and are there different types of food which benefit us at different ages without compromising on our health, please? And a quick response would be much appreciated.
Sure. Just to add to, before I go on, I don't make any money from the book, no royalties at all. It was purely made for educational purposes for the NHS. So I'm not in any way doing any PR exercise tonight.
I'm flagging the book up.
The World Food Program reflects on, I'm very sad to say that we were not able to see the images that I was referring to today. It's very much around having a meal that is going to meet your complete nutritional needs throughout the, you know, through your three meals. We're trying to showcase all the essential foods that you do need to have in the right proportion. Now, we know that obesity is on the rise and we're eating the wrong type of foods or maybe too much of certain foods. So in a simple answer, we are trying to promote people to continue to eat as a family, eat the foods that they are familiar with, but possibly reducing the quantities that they're eating of mostly carbohydrate type foods. So these are foods that we conventionally eat, such as potato, rice, bread, pasta, foods made out of flour. We know these foods are cheaper. We know that people generally tend to eat more of them, and that has a huge impact on people's weight, their diabetes, their blood pressure, and it's very much educating people to reduce their carbohydrate content and increasing the sources of protein. Now, protein is a very good food. Now, people generally refer to protein as meat, but we're educating people to increase their intake of pulses, beans, legumes, dals, things like also foods like tofu. So much more naturally forming foods. And then we're encouraging people to have more vegetables. So, you know, really trying to encourage people to try to not necessarily have the fresh vegetables from the market or which are more expensive, but even going for foods which are frozen options. But when we're talking about eating on a budget, we do talk about batch cooking. We talk about bulk buying and then what type of foods they can buy, which is going to be more cost effective for the whole family. So we always encourage people to look out for things like which are tin foods, what as about well, frozen, which are just Salma, as good for you.
Salma, sorry to interrupt you. What about very quickly, please? What about breakfast clubs and, sure. And Danny was talking about the evening meals and if you could very quickly touch up on that.
I'm really glad that did come up. So we know that there are lots of free school meal provisions, breakfast clubs, and I'm really pleased to hear that Danny's school is doing tremendously well in promoting healthy eating. On the other side, I do see the very much opposite in a lot of schools where they are giving free school meals and free breakfast clubs. And I have raised this with the local health authorities that offering fruit juices and offering very much high white bread processed foods to children of our communities is not going to benefit them in any way. If anything, it's going to have a detrimental effect on these children's health. Also offering a lot of processed foods such as chips, nuggets, sausages is still happening in a lot of schools. Every school I go to are offering a lot of desserts at mealtimes. And obviously these children are going to want to eat these foods, but we need to take a stand and start offering more fresh fruits and vegetables, more yogurts, more cheese, rather than the conventional, which I'm seeing again and again and again when I visit schools. It's very much heavily around chips, beans, and sort of French, fish fingers. And I generally tend to hear the children don't like vegetables, they only like chips. And so it's really educating the catering and as well as the teachers, as well as the children, and doing this as a collective change rather than raising any fingers or pinpointing at individual organizations.
Thank you. Thank you. That takes me nicely to Danny. Danny, why is this so important to you? And how does this benefit your pupils and generally the children and young people's educational attainment and their physical and mental wellness, please?
Okay, just to come back on Salma's point as well, it's a tragedy that so many school kitchens over the years have been sourced out to private companies who have a set menu and regulated portions, and food is shipped in the week in advance and stored in the freezer. That's one of the big problems. Fortunately, we've been able to resist that sort of privatisation of our kitchen, and the food is cooked freshly every day by a team of people who've been there for 30 odd years.
I like coming down because it's exciting. I bring my son Leo to the club. We usually come every week.
I think someone's agreeing with me there. So just as an aside, but I think, you know, you have to be conscious of the fact, Ketan, that young people come to school without a breakfast in the belly. The chances are they're not going to get fed until half past 12, 1 o'clock. And I put it past anybody listening to this presentation to perform productively and learn in no matter what you do if you haven't been fed. So it's as simple as that. So academic progress is absolutely tied to food nutrition and the healthy eating that children get. We run a breakfast club like everybody else does. The food's free for kids if they want to come along from 7:30. And the idea is clearly tied. It's not just a question of natural justice. It's also a question of ensuring that the children can perform well and behave well in class. The two things are absolutely linked.
Thank you very much for that, Danny. I am moving very swiftly because of the time pressures, so forgive me. I'm now going to very quickly turn to Rajesh. Rajesh, you reference some of the stuff that you are doing so amazingly well. You mentioned the kitchen garden that you have at St. Raffles, and I'm just keen to understand, how does that play in enhancing the mental and physical wellness, please?
In so many ways, it's actually a social therapeutic space. It's been created largely by volunteers in the local community and from outside the very local community, even from outside of Brent, who've come along and made this a reality. We grow about 70 varieties of organic fruit and vegetables. We've got about 20 chickens that lay free range eggs. Last year, we harvested about 420 kgs of organic produce. Interesting, over the pandemic, when we were in lockdown, we had to do things differently. And one of the things that we did is we helped local residents, many of whom, because we're based on St. Raphael's estate, which is one of the most disadvantaged communities in Brent, the housing estate in Brent. And many people there don't have a garden and they therefore can't grow much. And what we did is we handed out hundreds of pounds worth of soil and seeds. And we helped residents to construct beds that they could use. And we've also used some communal spaces and encouraged people to get out there and grow their own food and get involved. Now, obviously, the food itself is nutritious, but you know, the physical benefits of getting out, particularly during lockdowns, was very noticeable. And the mental health impact, you know, there's lots of quotes and feedback that we've got from residents who just, this was a lifesaver for them, just being able to be together outside and to socialize and to grow food together. So there's a lot that we do. There's various mental health wards from groups with physical health needs who come down and use the space regularly.
Thank you very much for that. So friends, I started off our conversation with Lander, and I'm going to end with Lander. And Lander, in a minute or less now, if you could just very quickly just give us insight into how important the food, the role of food played in the research paper in health and wellbeing agenda, please.
Thanks. Thanks for that question, Ketan. I think I want to thank everybody else as well for such a comprehensive overview. I think we've touched upon a lot of topics, and then I want to thank the other panelists for providing those insights. From my perspective, it's absolutely crucial. You know, the food really stood out as not only driving health, but also driving family connection, vital to mental health and well-being, instilling good dietary habits. And there is a strong argument to support families in having home-cooked family meals with touch upon school meals. So all those aspects really came back throughout the research. If I may just come back and stress something what's been picked up on as well, I see in the chat, is that people made those food choices based on what's available to them in their surroundings and in line with their financial resources. So it's not an individual's responsibility necessarily, nor a family's responsibility, or let's say to have the blame of an unhealthy dietary pattern, if that makes sense. What really stands out is that the environment in which we live, the environment to which children in my particular research are exposed in terms of food, that is what determines their dietary intake. So it's absolutely crucial to take those all those aspects into conjunction, whether it's at the school, at the home, and most certainly also from my research, from the environment. And I think interlinking those aspects, as we've done today, I think during this session, is absolutely crucial. So thanks for that, Ketta.
Thank you very much. So friends, I did say that we would not be able to do justice to this very, very significant area, very complex area within 1 hour. But the purpose of this hour was to open up the discussion, to set the scene for us to think a bit more about what we hear and what we see in the newspaper headlines. And hopefully this has been a useful forum to start off that conversation, start off that journey to something much more better in coming months for all of us, for all of our families, for all of our neighborhoods. So thank you very much indeed. We'll continue with this conversation in coming months, no doubt, in different forums. But I will hand you back to Judith for a quick thanks to our guests who have made a huge amount of time to be with us this evening. Judith?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Ketan, and thank you to the amazing panel for their insightful, challenging and inspiring contributions.